Okay, good morning everyone. Welcome to another New Energy Chinwag with myself, John Massey, and Charlie Rattan. Morning, Charlie.
Good day, everybody.
So today we thought we'd talk about a topic which could end up being quite general. We could end up talking about it for hours, but we'll try and keep it reasonably under control. And that was, there's been a lot of talk about economic recovery, post-virus recovery, particularly here in the UK. The government have been talking about this week about opening the spending taps and build. So we thought we'd have a quick chat in that context, I guess, particularly here in the UK, around what they should build, because obviously everyone, every man and his dog is kind of lobbying for money, be it the hydrogen sector, which kind of doesn't really exist yet. They want a kickstart to get that going. There's been some things that have kind of been contrary to that. There's been some delays to some offshore wind permitting processes, which we can maybe get into. Obviously, the electrification side are also interested in getting hold of that money. So there's going to be lots of pressures, lots of lobbying and lots of influences on where the money should go. There's obviously a finite pot of money. So Charlie, the things you've seen over the last week in particular, have you got any sense of where things might go?
Yeah, I suppose, like yourself, John, we track the industry and we track wider economic realities as well. And there's been quite a lot of mood music, hasn't there, about a whole heap of infrastructure type of projects. The current Tory regime seems to be moving back to almost Keynesian type of principles of perhaps now is perhaps a good time to invest. Interest rates are low. We do need a recovery. So perhaps we can stimulate the economy through large infrastructure projects, which brings us into our domain, doesn't it, with clean tech. And we talk about things like offshore wind. And I suppose the one that you mentioned just now, a bit of pushback, I think Norfolk Vanguard got permitted or consented yesterday, John, but a couple of pushbacks on Ørsted, wasn't it? I think Hornsea C. And again, it's all very well to have, lines in policy and big industrial strategies and all the rest of it. But ultimately, you do have to go through a rigorous EIA or environmental statement process. It's then assessed by PINS and others. And then ultimately, it's a political decision. And if there is a discomfort from and objections from certain stakeholders, you are not going to get your consent. And even when you do get it, you might get some very expensive planning conditions, which people often forget. And there was some pushback. So we'll wait and see what the reasons for those are, whether it might be offshore, it might be on birds, it might be on cumulative impact, which is often forgotten. There's so many wind farms now offshore that it impacts other wind farms, and that might be in the way that the cables get to shore. It might be another thing. Yeah.
Just to come in on that, I think it was a good example of having a national strategy is all very well, but this, my understanding is a lot of this is coming down. It's coming down to local issues, and you just mentioned cabling there. I know there's been a lot of opposition in Norfolk and East Anglia around cabling routes, and although the wind farms themselves are offshore, there's concerns about the Norfolk countryside being dug up with corridors of cabling, and so there's some other proposals about having cabling routes offshore and single places that they come onshore. But I mean, aside from the detail, it just struck me as a good example where whatever the government decide in terms of where they're going to put the money or where they want to put these big infrastructure money, ultimately, you're still going to have to get through that. It could fall at the hurdle of kind of local impact.
Yeah, I think the grey hairs upon my barnet are added, testimony to that, John. People forget that when they come up with these national strategies and these great things that are announced. They just assume to some extent that it's a done deal, and of course it's not, and rightly so, because we do live in a democracy and there are a whole heap of stakeholders that want a say. And even if they don't object, they will certainly steer you in a certain direction. And that direction might be expensive. It might involve things you'd not anticipated. And unless you engage, you are not going to get your permit through. So I'm not saying that this isn't an engagement issue, but if you were close to, you might live miles away from these wind farms. You might say, well, I live 30 miles away from this wind farm, but the cable is actually going through the bottom of my garden. And it's not just one cable, there might be half a dozen wind farms going the same route. And that's not universally acclaimed at a local level. And we do have a system where MPs are beholden to constituents, and rightly so. So it's, I sometimes think it's a little bit naive to come up with these grand, you know, these names get better and better, like giga stacks and national strategies. But ultimately, you've got to go to the village halls and the local communities, hard at the moment, and engage and win people over. And obviously, some of these major projects have got a little bit more work to do.
Yeah, and in terms of, I guess, there's a whole host of things that want money that I've noticed over the last few days. I mean, there's been, I think there was a bunch of stuff about house building. I know there's a lot of concern there about whether, in the rush to churn out lots of new houses, lost in that will be churning out energy efficient, ideally zero carbon houses. So whether that will happen, there's been obviously from the hydrogen side, there's lobbying from the kind of the transport section. Equinor just yesterday or the day before was talking about building their project. Obviously they sell gas, so they're quite keen on gas reforming, and that was very much going to be tied in with carbon capture and storage. So that's another industry which particularly the oil and gas sector are keen to push. There's a whole bunch of different areas in terms of battles between kind of electrification and hydrogen, for example, but also then down to things like insulation, energy efficiency, I think, is moving up the agenda quite a lot. So, yeah, it'd be interesting to see where this money goes.
Some of these are not new, of course, and you sometimes wonder whether there's an opportunity to rehash older schemes. I'm thinking of the Tide scheme in Swansea, for example, that seems to have been around a long time. But I remember a thing called the CERT scheme was going to be doing some of the insulation stuff on houses. And then we had the Merton rule that came and went. But of course, it's a good opportunity. And if you are a lobby group, I mean, you've got to lobby for something, I suppose. And top of the list would be more money for our particular group. So everybody has been lobbying. So I suppose the government is going to give everybody a little piece of the pie. And people like you and I will read the tea leaves and say, oh, the greenies have got a little bit less than the blueies, if you like, in the hydrogen. Or this scheme has got but these schemes have been around for years, some of them. And of course, you don't just give up all that hard work. If you've worked for 10 years on a project, you don't just say, oh, I've not got the consent. You might say, well, let's have a look at why we didn't. Can we recalibrate it? Can we link it in with other schemes? Can we look for synergies? Have things changed? And so, sometimes that can work for a real benefit. I'm thinking of Seagreen, which I was involved with for years for SSE. And although it was delayed, that we went to a judicial review. The scheme that's come out of it is actually much, much better. Fewer turbines, because the tech has moved on so much. And so they've come out, ironically, with a much more effective scheme as a result of delays. So there are, I haven't seen much on the road sector this time, John. I don't know if you've seen any big push for any motorways. Seem to be more or less there. Might be a couple of tweaks.
Not road building. I mean, there's a few things that have come out recently. I mean, the Climate Change Committee did their update report, which kind of reiterated some of the things they've got. I would have thought we'll see some movement in terms of things like charging infrastructure in terms of roads. I don't think in terms of road building, I've not seen much on that. There's been some little stuff. I think is it now legal to rent electric scooters or something? I mean, there's all sorts of small things. I mean, Swansea was an interesting one that you mentioned. Tidal.
Yeah.
I mean, that came up again because last week they were waiting. It was something to do with a decommissioning plan, or there was some specific detail which hadn't been approved, and they were concerned about losing their planning permission. And so that was still in the news. And there was another one. Was it Cardiff? There was another Welsh mayor who was coming up talking about tidal lagoons and so on. I guess it kind of raised in my mind one of the challenges, I think, here is because obviously everyone wants to things that create jobs at the moment, because unemployment's likely to shoot up. So everyone is kind of saying, okay, well, we can build this and it will create X thousand jobs, but we need government support to do it. I think one of the challenges is going to be that is where do you draw the line? So Swansea Bay, for example, the problem with that was in the past they wanted some huge amount of subsidy to be able to do it. And I don't dispute it would create lots of jobs and boost the local economy and so on. But I guess from a government point of view, you've still got to make kind of decisions that you can't just throw money at anything without limit. It's going to be kind of how do you tread the pathway of where do you throw the money to, yes, create jobs, but also not to create them at all costs, to have some kind of, I don't know how you'd go about doing that kind of value. I don't know if there's
any formula. Obviously, most jobs will be at the construction stage. So you really, if you're smart, you'd be looking at the O&M phase, which is by far the longest part of any project. And offshore wind, that can be up to 60 years now. And I don't know what the tidal goon length is. But if you've got a nice O&M strategy with plenty of jobs in there, that might raise it above just one that's like construction, which is the upfront short term.
Yeah, or you need it to be kind of rolling construction. I mean, with offshore wind, because the advantage there is that with construction jobs, we have a clear kind of rolling strategy to build out more and more capacity. So when one construction finishes, another one starts. I guess one of the challenges with the Swansea Bay is if the proposal was to build, you had a pathway to build kind of one every 2 years or something, you could say, well, when that construction finishes, another one starts, whereas that was very much a kind of single proposal. So
that's a good point that you've raised there, because I think actually what you're actually getting at there is the cost reduction element of all of this, which, however straitened times are at the moment, the government and certainly the Treasury will be keen upon. And so I suppose to get that mass and that scale that we have talked about for the hydrogen economy, for example, which is still nascent, but offshore wind has got, I think, a 40 gigawatt target within 10 years. That's an eye-wateringly quadrupling of where we are now. And yet we're still seeing projects push back. You say, well, how can that be? But that's the nature of it. If you would say, well, if you move it, I think we did do a podcast on Wave and Tidal not the same tech, but I think one of our conclusions was that actually it's not as scalable as some of the other kit around. If you look around at offshore wind, it can go, it can scale very quickly and the costs can come down. But if you're in more of a niche market, then it's difficult to get those economies of scale in, and you're going to struggle to reduce the support needed to get projects away. And I'm sure that the Treasury and other government departments are well aware of that bang for your buck, if you like, and especially with the job elements as well.
Yeah, and not just in that case, not just looking locally, you're also looking at whether it's a big market globally. I mean, offshore wind is going to be a very big market globally. So expertise and intellectual property and other things that you generate here, you can also then create exports. There's a big export market out there. Whereas I guess you could look at tidal, and there are only certain places in the world where tidal makes sense. There's no, even if that some tidal projects come on stream, there's no sense that it's suddenly going to be a massive chunk of the energy mix in different places. So how much export capacity is there as well in the long run? So it's kind of about putting your money somewhere where there's not just a short-term job boost, but also long-term value creation, I suppose.
You're dead right. As I've been on the circuit, certainly you go to some of the supply chain events and you've got these pop-up posters now. You know, exporting is great. You never used to see the Department for International Trade necessarily at wind events, but you certainly do now. In fact, they're being very, very proactive about it. So clearly, they, with their leverage, and it's a global leverage, can see the opportunity. So it's 40 gigs by 2030, but that's not the end of it. There's a whole heap of stuff behind it. And of course, there's things like decommissioning. It was very interesting that decommissioning, which is usually resolved by various bonds and things, I think got caught out a little bit by oil and gas, in that people didn't really think about decommissioning plans back in the 1970s. So I will think about that 10 years before the decommissioning occurs, and then you run it for 30, 40 years, and then suddenly it's upon you. So unless you address that, and usually there's a degree of commitment required up front often, then you're going to struggle. And it's odd that a thing like decommissioning, I would have thought a tidal would be a long-term project, perhaps with slightly lower returns, but I thought you'd be looking for best part of 100 years for a project like that. And I suppose you'd then say, well, like, who knows what's going to be around to decommission in 100 years? You might have different vessels, different kit, different means of doing about it. It's not just going to be a case of just reversing how we build it, because that's naive given the time spans involved.
So yeah, I think certainly Swansea Bay, though, I mean, that was part of their argument, was we can, it's kind of, it'll be there for 80 years or 100 years or whatever. I think the problem is when you get to those timescales, people kind of glaze over a little bit from an investment point of view. I mean, that's someone's entire lifetime. Then are they really that bothered? And from a policy point of view, again, they'll be long buried before then. So there's a time horizon above which, in theory, yes, you can look at the lifespan and say, well, you're spreading the costs over that amount of time and so on. But I think there's a lifespan over which I think people start to kind of glaze over a little bit. And again, who knows, given the changes we've seen in the last 10 or 15 years, in 30 years, who knows what the energy landscape will look like or what will have happened. I mean, maybe the government will have invested in fusion and made it happen, and we won't be worrying about tidal lagoons at all. I'm not suggesting that's likely to happen, but I mean, it's just a time horizon.
Well, it's possible. You discount nothing. I suppose one thing I didn't pick up in reading the tea leaves is this decommissioning element, because the figures are eye-watering, but it also involves jobs as well. And I suppose a smart strategy from some of the things we've talked about is repurpose some of the oil and gas platforms, but also dismantle some. Not everything's going to be suitable for reuse, and those are the ones that you could say, well, that would be the quick jobs that you mentioned. And also then think about the wider picture out in the North Sea. I've seen some really ambitious stuff, whether it emerged through the mincer of the policy this week, I don't know, but there's some really ambitious talk around the North Sea, and that we should be looking at the North Sea, not just in isolation, but as an integrated whole. And that involves Holland and Germany and the UK, now out of the EU, but also Norway and other countries as well. And these are so ambitious. But I suppose that brings me to the point of the energy islands thing that I mentioned as well. It's not really caught hold in the UK. There was a scheme in the North Sea, I think off Dogger, which is quite shallow, but that was across a number of jurisdictions, and it doesn't seem to have gone anywhere very quickly. But if you were to be thinking about mega projects, certainly on a European level, you would be looking at, I think the Danes came up with these energy islands, two of them, yeah. One was in the Baltic and one was in the North Sea, and you'd be looking and say, well, look, if you are looking for quick wins, you want to be involved in these energy islands, which I think are now consented.
There was an announcement, I think, I can't remember what stage they were. I think they maybe got permission to start looking at them. They obviously weren't financed or anything yet. I mean, obviously the Danes are very, as an energy system, electricity system, they're very interconnected anyway, because they generate more, they commonly generate more than they use. So they're interconnected with Germany, Norway, other places anyway, for moving power about. So it makes lots of sense. I guess the balance there is that some of those aren't going to happen anytime soon. Even if they're consented, they're not immediate. So I think there'll be, what will be interesting to see is how the government balances the need for immediate employment, because they've got a massive recession on the way, against some of the longer term stuff. So can you identify kind of things that are both quick wins and also build towards a kind of longer term future? Or is the danger, as I say, with things like house building, is that the quick win is to just sort of chuck up houses as quickly as possible, and then in another 10 years time you suddenly find you're going to have to go and retrofit them all with better heating insulation systems and all that kind of stuff. I mean, maybe sounds slightly cynical, but it wouldn't be the first time that governments have
no, well,
taken a rather short-term view.
And of course, you've got, I keep banging on about the planning process. People just think you can go and stick, build 500,000 houses or something, but it's not as simple as that. There's all kinds of things to consider, not least green belts and some pretty powerful stakeholders. And if they object, you haven't got to, you go straight to inquiry. So, and that's going to put 4 or 5 years on many, many projects, which certainly doesn't come into the quick win scenarios that I think we're talking about. One thing I did see that I thought was significant was this digger chugging about on the news, BBC News at 10 the day before last, hydrogen powered. So it's a hydrogen powered JCB digger. And I think it's a sign of how far certainly hydrogen has come. But I think 4 or 5 minute slot on main evening news regarding this this JCB digger chugging around with its only exhaust being water. Effectively, so if they were to look for quick wins, and they were to look for kind of heavy plant, transporty, construction emissions, you could do worse. And I'm not sure how the how the cookie crumbles, if you like, than invest in things like. And I'm sure that lobby is being made in things like this this digger that is now world's first. It seems to be up and running. It seems to be successful. And you might say, well, let's push the boat out a bit, or push the digger out a bit, and get this rolled out on a scale where it can be exported as well.
Yeah, I mean that's a prime example where they're going to have lobbying from both sides. Of course, I mean the Caterpillar about a year ago launched a battery powered digger, looks almost identical. So you've got the kind of battle between the kind of battery and hydrogen at various levels. But yeah, I mean again, it would be around, I guess, not just the fuel source, but they'd be looking at things like employment. They'd be looking at the other infrastructure along with that as well. But yeah, you get some interesting. It's going to be, I guess, the point is they're faced with. People can kind of smell that money and investment is coming, and potentially subsidy is coming, which sort of everyone suddenly gets interested in the lobbying side of it. I mean, there are other things like I guess that's where maybe looking back at the Climate Change Committee report and what the framework that gives is of interest. I mean, because that includes things like carbon capture and storage. I mean, they're fairly positive in terms of looking at carbon capture and storage as something that's not optional, that they think it's something that's actually required. It's something that doesn't really on any grand scale exist yet. So that would kind of give comfort, I suppose, if you're the kind of Equinors of this world looking to produce carbon capture and storage. It's kind of, there are projects like that where they're very much pushing this idea that, well, it doesn't really exist on a big scale. We'd like to be a world leader if we develop it here, as well as meeting our own net zero ambitions. Potentially, it's something that we can, it's expertise that we can use elsewhere.
Yeah, you mentioned right at the top of this this podcast, didn't you, that Equinor scheme. Do you know any more details about it? It was a carbon capture. It was over on Humberside, wasn't it, that one?
Yeah, it's, I'd have to go back to the release yesterday. I don't think it's a new thing. I think it's basically one of the blue hydrogen Humber schemes they've announced in the past. So they basically they produce gas. So not surprisingly, they'd like to steam reform gas to hydrogen to make it clean. They obviously have to capture and store the carbon that they produce, and they do that under the North Sea. So I think it was a bit of a rehash, but I think the announcement, it was one of these where the announcement I read, I think it was yesterday or the day before, said Equinor will build this hydrogen carbon capture and storage facility. Actually, when you look at the detail, it's kind of, they will build it if they get appropriate level of government support, which basically means that, again, it's all part of the kind of thing.
Yeah, and I suspect that's the real story, John. I think the timing, obviously every major company's got a comms department, and they've got people that liaise with government and so forth, and they look for the timings of the announcements. And I think the timing of the announcement on the back of Boris Johnson was that on Wednesday he stood up and gave his recovery speech, and then the day afterwards then this one is announced. So the timing, I think, was the key element to that, and we'll see whether that happens. But obviously there's a much bigger cluster developing around Humberside as well, and that does form part of the clustering objectives that we've talked about in the past, and that may also be a good mechanism for some kind of recovery, if you are to be recovering, or why not pick a cluster and run with it, or pick a couple of them and push now.
Yeah, and also it's almost the reverse of we talked about local versus national a few minutes ago, and we talked about it in terms of potentially a negative impact. So nationally you want to do things and locally you can't. I guess those clusters are examples where actually a lot of the push will come locally, because it's local government and local chambers of commerce and local interests wanting to grow these clusters, because it's they want to draw money into their local economy, potentially at the expense of some other local economy. But it's their examples of where maybe it's something that's the push is actually coming locally, and the slowing down or the restriction is maybe that they need support through national policy to do that. So it's almost a kind of reverse in that sense, which is again a kind of interesting thing. I mean, it ties up and potentially it'll be driven partly by this kind of, they keep talking about this leveling up scenario, not terribly well defined, but broadly speaking, more stuff in the north, not less stuff in the south, but less less focused just on things in the south and more projects further afield. So again, it's kind of tying in some of those that are part of this kind of whole lobbying fundraising effort is going to be tying in again with some of those political priorities beyond just energy.
I think you've hit upon a very interesting point there, and that you've almost got an organic element to these clusters. Certainly, if I was to think of the one that I've got close relationships based around the city of Chester, and I looked, I think, at Broughton this week, there are a few thousand redundancies for the Airbus that's made in that area. But at the same time, there's a nascent cluster around Ellesmere, Port Cheshire, and a lot of it is based around refineries and steam reforming, possibly for the hydrogen, and then using some of the pipelines out at the sea. And that would be a good argument to put. But we've just lost thousands of roles down the down the road. But now would be a good time to push our cluster, and especially if that cluster is the same people effectively that are so badly affected by some of the reductions in the same area. So it would be a very smart argument. I'm sure people will put that to government, in that their cluster, if you like, deserves preference. I don't know. We've talked a little bit in the past about, is it going to be clusters supporting clusters, or really is it a bit of a beauty contest where you say, well, actually, we really do need this one to be prioritised, and our cluster's the best.
Yeah, I mean, I suspect from a national government point of view, actually clusters, what they mainly need are probably national policies that allow or improve the economics of some of the things they want to do. So, for example, clusters that depend on, are going to be reliant on carbon capture and storage, in the absence of any kind of national framework to encourage that, because at the moment it's, why would you pay for carbon capture and storage when it's cheaper to just emit? That's sort of depending on, there's partly from a national point of view, it's just having the right national policy in place. And then obviously there'll be a bun fight between them about attracting finance, because there might only be a finite amount of kind of private finance floating around. So, but from a national government point of view, I don't think you always need national policy to dictate on particular clusters. I think you just need national policy to provide a framework which any cluster could thrive in, but then it's up to the clusters individually to compete for the pots of money and make the case to investors beyond that. Now, again, there might be things that national government can do around local that affect local planning restrictions. I don't know enough about to, off the top of my head, come up with an example of what that might be. But I think a lot of the national policy could apply anywhere, and then it's just up to the anywheres to compete with either with each other or with other things for money.
I think when they were developing the Docklands, I think, so there was a kind of fast-tracking planning regime brought in, because they didn't get in universal acclaim. And of course, it's a difficult one for the government to do, because it's not going to please. It's quite a controversial measure to just chuck out the planning laws and the planning regime just because you want something fast-tracked because of a crisis. It's even fast-track is quite relatively slow-track, I suppose, in certain circumstances. But I suppose the government has to be seen to be doing something, even if it does take a few years for some of this stuff to come into fruition. It's not going to be a lot of new planning applications just been coming from nowhere. There'll be stuff that's already circulating, marginal schemes that people have been umming and eyeing about it. Perhaps they can see, oh, well, there is a bit of support. We'll put that one back in, or we'll recycle it. We'll recycle these gas salt caverns and make them hydrogen salt caverns. Or this offshore gas field is coming to the end of its life. Let's fast track something else that synergizes with it. And that is, I suppose, quite smart from those involved as well. So there's an element of smart thinking out there as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, I'm not a expert on planning things, but I know the government can kind of designate things as kind of strategically important and nationally important, can't they? I mean, that's what they do for airports and so on, where you'd never get anything done. I mean, you still never get anything done. It's a prime example that the government wanted to happen, and it still never happens. But yeah, and on the sort of gas oil field repurposing, again, that, I guess that ties into decisions will also be focused on kind of, I guess, reskilling particular sectors that do employ a lot of people and repurposing them. So that might drive, again, I guess it's just making the point, a lot of these decisions are not all going to depend on kind of thermodynamics and efficiency and things that you can put on a spreadsheet. There's going to be, there's also going to be sort of politics, economics, social, local dimensions to all these things as well, which determine kind of what the energy system will look like going forwards. I guess to follow on from that, which means that different countries will go down different routes. And I suppose another question I had was, I mean, there's, you get a lot of this kind of, oh, well, we don't want to be left behind on X, Y, and Z, and look at what this country's doing, and look how much X country's spending on such a technology and so on. I mean, do you think, what's your feeling on some of that? I mean, different solutions.
With the railways, didn't we? With the French railway system, and then we came across with our HS2, which hasn't been universally acclaimed, but I think there's still existing commitment to that. It's always difficult, isn't it, just say, oh, China's spending all this, so we should be spending on that. It's not always like for like. I did see on back to the energy side, I did see that it's not hydrogen tech, but it is a kind of compressed air tech, this cryogenic battery that's just 5 miles up the road from me at Bury seems to have been gained a planning consent on the other side of Manchester at Trafford, and that is a much bigger commercial scheme, which is worthy of note from people like ourselves in the energy sector. And of course, it also fits into what was a much bigger mini cluster, if you like, on the west of Manchester, around the Carrington area. And funnily enough, also coincides with job losses at the nearby Trafford Centre as well. So you could say that it's not a cluster per se, but this is almost inventing terms, like a mini cluster. But I think the cryogenic battery has obviously passed through planning, and it looks as though it's going to be built out and on a commercial scale as well. And I suppose the difference between that and the hydrogen storage element is that this is tends to be a bit shorter term. I don't know that much about cryogenic batteries or compressed air batteries, but I gather it's not the seasonal stuff. It's much, much shorter term.
Yeah, it's the Highview one, isn't it? They've also got some contracts in the States as well, I think, to do it.
Yes, that's right.
And it sort of ties in quite well with industrial facilities, because for the efficiency, I think they're quite dependent on kind of waste heat or waste cooling. That's an interesting example, because obviously they've not, as far as I'm aware, they've not depended on any kind of policy support to push that through. They may have initially whether there was some grants and some funding that helped get it off the ground, but as of now, I think they're looking at it on a more commercial basis. The contracts they're signing are with kind of utilities or with people or with industrial plants on a commercial basis. So yeah, I guess it's finding that balance. There's some things that obviously are here and can be done, and you don't really have to give much support. And then there'll be some things that might take a bit longer, are harder to do need some support. And then it's determining, well, which, because everyone wants some support, which ones do we go down, and where do we throw the money?
Yeah, I mean, even nuclear, I mean, I don't know what the support of that. Has there been anything about Sizewell C this week at all? Has there been any announcements about that?
I mean, every man and his dog, given the last couple of weeks, have been kind of saying we need support. So, I mean, the nuclear, I mean, that constantly pops up. Sizewell C, they have, I think they've finally submitted their planning application, I think. Is that the right? I think that's there's something happened recently, but I mean the thing with nuclear is all about the funding. Where do you get the money? What are the costs going to be? How can you justify the costs? And again, they talk about the fact it's a long term project. It'll be there for 60 years and 80 years, whatever. And then all this stuff about it's kind of firm power rather than variable power, and we can argue about whether, so what, do we need that, or what, do we actually need flexible power? There's Sizewell, but then there's a whole bunch of other projects that I think are dependent on whether that happens as to whether they progress. There's, I think, Anglesey is still floating around, and again there are some, I mean, there are geopolitical issues around some of these. Was it Anglesey? I think I think the U.S. State Department had done been saying something about don't allow the Chinese to. There's all sorts of things around nuclear as well. But yeah, certainly it's very much part in the lobbying game. And particularly the subsidy they're looking for is around this kind of CFDs and around the pricing, as far as I'm aware. And or potentially, actually, the other one is the funding model. I can't remember the term for it, but they've been trying to push a funding model, which is basically more kind of state ownership and state taking the risk on the upfront cost, which again is not going to be wildly popular, I would suggest.
One thing that might be worth teasing out of the discussion, we've covered a lot, but one thing, do you think there's a difference between giving incumbents and supporting innovation, of the way that you'd make the two calls? Because obviously some of the things that we talk about hydrogen, which isn't really there yet. It's maybe what it's talking about it, as we've said, but there's not really openly accepted much out there. But perhaps it's more comfortable to existing. If you're a shareholder in a company and you've got shares in the old favourite oil and gas, I haven't seen much about that this week, how the oil and gas, other than that they're tilting towards more renewables, but I haven't seen any specific talk about support for them. But do you think there's a difference between when a government makes the call, do we support the existing arrangements, or do we back what we think are likely winners for the future? And it might be ones that, as you've already said, other countries have picked the same winners. So even if you do back them, you still end up in second place because somebody's backed them with more conviction or with a better fit to the rest of the economy.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a few things in there. I mean, I think clearly you want to be backing stuff that's future-proof. So not just propping up current things, but backing stuff that's interesting in future. I think on the countryside, as in talking about countries, not the rural countryside. I think it's important to recognise that different countries will have different best solutions or optimum solutions. So again, that's why I'm kind of wary and raise the issue about, well, when people say, oh, we're going to fall behind X, Y, and Z on a particular thing, you've got to think about, well, what's the most appropriate solution in a different country? And also, is falling behind them always a bad thing? And lots of countries were miles behind Germany on solar power, for example, and they were probably quite pleased because Germany paid a fortune when solar was very expensive to install it. And then lots of other countries kind of, if you like, freeloaded on the back of that, waiting for the costs come down and installed big capacities much more cheaply. So there's a kind of, there can be first mover disadvantages as well as first mover advantages. And I suppose the other one that I think you raised was also, do you back, or you kind of hinted at, do you back big companies or small companies? I mean, that's an interesting one. Should we be Obviously, the big companies have all the kind of lobbying power and make a lot of the noise. But should a big chunk of funding go towards things that may not be kind of proven at this stage, but are kind of innovations? I mean, what should the split be between money for deployment, and particularly if that deployment is going to be by big companies, where you think, well, why can't you use some of your own money, take some of your own risk, versus innovation for kind of smaller companies, supply chain companies, kind of disruptive technology companies, which individually might be smaller chunks of money, but you might need to throw a bit of money at a lot of them, and a chunk of that money you'd have to accept will never go anywhere because they'll never become commercial. But unless you do that, can you lead against other countries and against other economies on technology? If you're just investing stuff that you're certain about, at what point do you have to take a chunk of money and invest in things that may or may not happen? But if you want to actually be ahead, you've got to be some of it's got to be kind of R&D, and not necessarily kind of university like level R&D, but money to get people beyond the kind of R&D stage and into kind of, for example, being able to build their first pilot
like this cryo battery thing. Somebody must have taken some risk at someone, but now it there is. Of course, innovation doesn't always equate to jobs, and as we've seen with the sector deal for offshore wind, and indeed SMEs, the government wants jobs. It's not going to just back something unless it sees. And long-term jobs as well, all right, you can say it would be jobs in construction, but that's gone in 18 months. And what about the longer term? And I haven't teased out some of the stuff that's come out, where the longer-term jobs are going to be for this, because it's not always a case of inject your money, but get lots of jobs in return, especially with retail taking a bit of a battering this week.
Well, yeah, and also, transferable, I mean, just because if a bunch of shops close, it doesn't mean that those people can go and work at a cryogenic storage facility. So there's, again, I think looking for, there's going to be a lot of skills transfer, a lot of skills training, but also looking at, it might be easier, maybe you mentioned Airbus. Again, I don't know what the kind of specific skills being lost there are, but how are there certain things that are more transferable than others, again, in the short run, as opposed to the long run. So yeah, certainly, but you're right, I mean, jobs is going to drive a lot of this. I mean, and I'm back to the innovation, I mean, SMEs, I can't remember what the split is, but if you look at how much the value SMEs generate and how many jobs small companies, small medium enterprises have as a share of the total, it's a big chunk. So again, that, in my mind,
the workhorse of the economy,
kind of supporting them. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, so
go ahead.
I suppose, yeah, even some of the bigger companies might be pleading poverty I suppose everybody's going to be pleading poverty, however deep you might think the coffers are, and everybody will be asking for some kind of support.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's obviously, in some ways, it's much easier for those bigger companies to kind of make their voice heard, I suppose. I don't know what the smaller companies, I mean, there's obviously a variety of associations and forums and things and chambers of commerce and stuff around. But yeah, it'd be, again, I wonder, maybe that's something that as an industry, we've talked about sector deals and so on. Again, they can potentially be dominated by some of the bigger companies. It's almost whether there needs to be some kind of framework within which smaller players, innovators, kind of up and coming technology developers can have a bigger voice in the whole picture would be useful.
Yeah, a good point that. I'm not sure what, there must be frameworks, but of course with everybody being furloughed, I thought some of the SMEs might take a bigger hit in the shorter run than some of the larger players. But there must be frameworks for their voice to be heard out there. I suppose they will then say, well, look, yeah, however much we may raise our voice, there are bigger players out there with even bigger voices that sometimes can get the prizes at the end of it. I don't know. I haven't teased detail out of this current set of announcements to work out where the big value is going to go. But we've talked a lot about major infrastructure. Is there anything that we've not discussed today? Did you say anything about aviation in the announcements this week, for example?
No, and I mean, the announcements so far have been fairly vague. The announcements have been, we're going to spend some money. I think the, final point worth mentioning is, I think, is it in 2 weeks' time that the Chancellor is supposed to kind of outline in a bit more detail what the money is? So I think what we've seen is we've seen kind of vague sort of promises that infrastructure spending is going to happen. We've seen the Climate Change Committee with its kind of up-to-date report on where we are so far and recommendations and so on. I guess it's over the next couple of weeks. It'll be interesting to see. I think we'll start to learn some of the specifics. Now, obviously, they'll, as with all these things, they'll probably leak out from time to time before the announcement. And in fact, I mean, again, the cynic in me kind of thinks that they leak them out deliberately to kind of gauge opinion, so that they can make tweaks to their final announcement. So, but yeah, I think it's over the next few weeks, certainly on things like hydrogen. I think they've said that it's over the next few weeks they'll be a bit more specific about what they're going to say on things. So that's it, as we've said, as I think we've kind of pointed out, the devil is in the detail.
I suppose the debate is within now. At least I suppose the difference between the crisis of 2007-2008 is that we're not talking about another 10 years of austerity. They are talking about the old Keynesian idea of spending astutely at the right time to promote it. So there's been a bit of a seismic shift, and this is within the same party, with the same philosophy, coming to a realisation that 10 years of austerity won't wash now. We'll be on that stage. I think we've taken the pain, which you might argue, well, that's left us in good enough state to be able to spend a little bit prudently now.
Yeah, and also a big difference between then and now is there's a lot more general recognition that green growth or a recovery based on investments which have a clean element is not only going to be good in terms of meeting the targets that set themselves, but also just from a future-proof job point of view. I think there is a realization even amongst the kind of most, probably, well, maybe not the most die-hard kind of sort of, if you like, old-fashioned kind of politicians. But I think the vast majority now see that they see what other countries are doing. They see where the kind of jobs of the future are likely to come from. And so, in that sense, hopefully, it will be a bit of a it provides an excuse or a reason to kind of kickstart some of the kind of things that we talk about, some of the things we're interested in. I mean, most of them have kind of started off their own steam to some extent, but maybe we'll see particular areas get more of a kind of shove in the back to get moving. But no, I think we've covered a good chunk of stuff.
Yeah, and I think that is a very good summary at the end. I think we've said it. The things are slightly different now. There does seem to be a movement. I'm sure there'll be squabbling about who gets what, and they got than me. But I don't think that's going to go away. But I think we've covered many things today, and we'll wait and see. So I think it's a very, very interesting time, and a very interesting time to be, particularly in the energy sector, which didn't always have the glamour that perhaps it seems to have attracted at the moment.
Yeah. Okay. Let's leave it there. Thanks for listening, everybody, and we'll see you on the next one.
Yeah. If you've got ideas, listeners, that you'd like us to talk about, we do have a few. So thanks to those that have fed back. I'll have a chat with John, and we'll get those recorded in coming weeks. But please keep them coming. We love to hear from you. So thanks. Yeah. Thanks very much indeed.
And from hopefully that. a few more guests to come up as well. It's always quite nice to hear from voices other than ourselves. Okay. All right. See you soon. Bye. See you.